of Saddam Hussein. In 1997, the Standard ran a cover story titled Saddam Must Go. If the United States didn't launch a ground invasion of Iraq, the lead editorial warned, the world should, quote, get ready for the day when Saddam has biological and chemical weapons at the tips of missiles aimed at Israel and at American forces in the Gulf. In 1998, Crystal, along with Donald Rumsfeld and Robert Kagan, signed a letter to Clinton calling for, quote, removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. That same year, as the Clinton administration planned air raids on Iraq, Crystal and Kagan made their case for regime change. Unless we act in Iraq, they warned in a New York Times op-ed, the Middle East will be destabilized and American soldiers will have to pay a far heavier price when the international peace sustained by American leadership begins to collapse. Around this time, Bob Kagan became a fixture in the Weekly Standard offices. Kagan always struck me as very much like Crystal in that both were products of academia and had similar views on the world. The main difference was that Kagan was dumber and less charming. Crystal came off as erudite and urbane. Those were his basic strengths. Kagan, who, like Crystal, had a graduate degree from Harvard, seemed like an aging linebacker with a history of concussions. Rather than make his case during conversations in the office, Kagan just increased his volume. When challenged, he yelled and stormed off. I always thought Kagan was an idiot. Not that it slowed him down as a foreign policy expert in Washington. After the September 11 attacks, Crystal found a new opening to start a war with Iraq. He started pushing immediately. On September 12, 2001, as downtown New York smoldered, Crystal told NPR, I think Iraq is actually the big unspoken elephant in the room today. In another NPR appearance the next month, he said, we know that over the last 3 or 4 weeks, Saddam has moved many of his chemical and biological weapons programs in preparation for possible U.S. attacks. In November 2001, Crystal and Kagan wrote a piece in the Weekly Standard alleging that Saddam Hussein hosted a training camp for al-Qaeda fighters where terrorists had trained to hijack planes. They suggested that Mohammed Atta, mastermind of the 9/11 attack, was actively collaborating with Saddam's intelligence services. On the basis of no evidence, they accused Iraq of fomenting the anthrax attacks on American politicians and news outlets. What will it take for the FBI and the CIA to start connecting the dots here? Crystal and Kagan asked. A signed confession from Saddam? That confession never came. No evidence was ever found tying Iraq to the 9/11 attacks. Many people believed Crystal's claims. In the first couple of years after 9/11, it seemed like just about anything could be true. But even policymakers sympathetic to the idea of overthrowing the Iraq government and occupying the country found themselves worrying about the aftermath. Saddam goes, but what then? Crystal had no such concerns. He mocked those who did. If we want to be popular in the Arab world, we should liberate the people of Iraq from Saddam, he said during a Fox News appearance in April 2002. In November 2002, he predicted that removing Saddam would have a positive chain reaction effect across the Middle East. The following February, he declared that, quote, if we free the people of Iraq, we will be respected in the Arab world, and I think we will be respected around the world. In March 2003, 12 years of advocacy paid off. America attacked Iraq. Crystal was quick to boast about his triumph. As U.S. troops entered the country, Crystal told C-SPAN, this is going to be a 2-month war, not an 8-year war. To those concerned about the possibility of ethnic conflict within Iraq, Crystal waved his hand. There has been a certain amount of pop sociology, he explained a month after the invasion, that the Shia can't get along with the Sunni. There's almost no evidence of that at all. It's a measure of how little experts in Washington actually know that Crystal kept getting invited to speak as an authority on the Middle East. No evidence the Shia and Sunnis might fight each other in Iraq? Your average Arab cab driver would laugh at that claim. It's ridiculous. The Iraqi regime was repressive largely because it's so difficult to govern a country riven by religious factionalism, as modern Iraq always has been. Everyone who's been to the region knows that. Apparently nobody told Bill Crystal. Time has proved Crystal spectacularly wrong on Iraq, on the big questions as well as the specifics. He's never acknowledged that, much less apologized. He's too implicated. I'm not apologizing for something that I think was not wrong, Crystal said in 2014. The war to remove Saddam was the right thing, a necessary thing to do. 2 years later, he seemed even more disconnected from reality. The war in Iraq was right and necessary, and we won it, Crystal said. At the time, Mosul, once Iraq's second-largest city, was under the control of the Islamic State. Iraq was embroiled in a civil war that would kill at least 90,000 people. Because Crystal refused to learn from the failures he helped create, his foreign policy positions have remained unchanged for more than 25 years, even as the world has changed completely. To almost every problem, Crystal's solution remains the same: war, led by America. In the summer of 2006, Crystal demanded regime change in both Syria and Iran in response to fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. According to Crystal, taking out the leadership of both countries, while basically irrelevant to core U.S. interests, was somehow our war. Indeed, Crystal explained, Hezbollah's attacks on Israel were America's fault. We have been too weak and have allowed ourselves to be perceived as weak, he said. To atone for its weakness, Crystal argued, America should commence airstrikes against the Iranian regime immediately. It would be easier to act sooner rather than later, he wrote, without explaining why it was necessary for America to act at all. Yes, there would be repercussions, but they would be healthy ones, showing a strong America that has rejected further appeasement. Crystal's demands for war in the Middle East continued throughout the Obama administration. In 2011, he backed intervention in Libya, including with American ground troops. In 2013, he demanded an intervention in Syria to topple Assad. In 2014, he called for a reinvasion of Iraq to defeat the Islamic State. Under ordinary circumstances, Bill Crystal would be famous for being wrong. Crystal still goes on television regularly, but it's not to apologize for the many demonstrably untrue things he said about the Middle East, or even to talk about foreign policy. Instead, Crystal goes on TV to attack Donald Trump. In a remarkable late-life conversion, Crystal has become one of the most passionate critics of the Trump administration. Tellingly, it didn't begin like this. Crystal once defended Trump. In June 2015, just weeks after Trump announced for president, Crystal urged the other candidates in the race to listen carefully to what Trump was saying. Some of his rhetoric, Crystal said, resonated with voters, and for good reason. Quote, Trump understands that Americans like winning. Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them. Trump is aware the public believes international politics is more zero-sum than globalist elites like to think. Our enemies are getting stronger and stronger, by the way, and we as a country are getting weaker. So Trump is pro-tough trade negotiations, he's pro-China bashing, and he's pro-military. I will find within our military, I will find the General Patton, or I will find the General MacArthur, I will find the right guy, I will find the guy that's going to take that military and make it really work. Nobody will be pushing us around. A bit simple-minded, Crystal asked? Sure. Closer to the truth than the cocktail partiers at Davos? Probably. Closer in sentiment to the American people? Certainly. Crystal's qualified praise of Trump continued for months. Crystal frequently had more good things than bad to say about Trump. He criticized Trump's opponents for not bothering to understand his appeal. I remain not pro-Trump, but I'm once again drifting into the anti-anti-Trump camp, Crystal wrote in August 2015. Much of the criticism of Trump has the feel of falling, fairly or unfairly, into the hobgoblin of small minds category. Then came the South Carolina primary debate. Trump criticized the Iraq War and its promoters. Crystal erupted. He was as angry as he'd ever been in public about anything. Crystal denounced not just Trump, but anyone who didn't join him in denouncing Trump. Once upon a time, we had leaders who would have expressed their outrage at such a slander, he wrote in the Weekly Standard. They would have explained to the American people how extraordinarily irresponsible his slander was and would have done their best to discredit a man who could behave so irresponsibly. They would have pronounced him unfit to be president of the United States, and they would have mobilized their friends, supporters, and admirers to ensure so appalling an eventuality didn't come to pass. Suddenly, Crystal found himself aligned with the cocktail partiers at Davos he once mocked. Global elites might oppose the interest of American voters, but at least they didn't accuse Bill Crystal of lying about Iraq. Crystal lapsed into a kind of public nervous breakdown, once coming close to tears on television as he tried to stop Trump. He failed. Trump won the nomination, but Crystal barely took a breath. He began searching for a warm body willing to mount a third-party challenge that would guarantee Hillary Clinton's victory in the general election. Crystal had lunch with Mitt Romney in Washington to discuss a third-party run. He encouraged Senators Tom Cotton and Marco Rubio to jump into the race, as well as General James Mattis. When all of them declined, Crystal settled on a little-known writer for National Review named David French. French seemed nice enough, but he clearly didn't fully understand what he was getting into. Crystal tried to pressure French into running by preemptively announcing his candidacy. In May 2016, Crystal tweeted, "There will be an independent candidate, an impressive one, with a strong team and a real chance." Apparently, this scared French. Within days, he announced he wasn't running. Few voters noticed. Eventually, Crystal drafted a congressional staffer and former CIA employee named Evan McMullen. Like French, McMullen was new to public life, all but unknown outside his immediate circle of acquaintances. But McMullen had two qualities essential for the job Crystal had in mind: unusually high self-regard and a willingness to defend the Iraq War. McMullen entered the race. He finished in November with less than 1% of the vote. Trump's election seemed to undo Bill Crystal entirely. He lost his job at the Weekly Standard after more than 20 years, forced out by owners who were panicked about declining readership. He seemed to spend most of his time on Twitter ranting about Trump. Before long, he was ranting about the people who elected Trump. At an American Enterprise Institute panel event in February of 2017, Crystal made the case for why immigrants are more impressive than native-born Americans. Basically, if you're in a free society, a capitalist society, after two, three, four generations of hard work, everyone becomes kind of decadent, lazy, spoiled, whatever. Most Americans, Crystal said, grew up as spoiled kids and so forth. A year later, Crystal had moved even further. In February 2018, Crystal tweeted that he would, quote, "take in a heartbeat a group of newly naturalized American citizens over the spoiled native-born know-nothings who supported Trump." By the spring of 2018, Crystal was considering a run for president himself. He was still making the case for the invasion of Iraq, as well as for pushing for a new war, this time in Syria and maybe in Lebanon and Iran, too. Like most people in Washington, he'd learned nothing at all. Chapter 4. Shut up, they explained. If you're going to run a country for the benefit of a few, it's dangerous to let people complain about it. The only way to impose unpopular policies on a population is through fear and silence. Free speech is the enemy of authoritarian rule. That's why the framers put it at the top of the Bill of Rights. That's also why our ruling class seeks to crush it. Not that any ruling class has ever supported free speech for long. In the summer of 1917, a Socialist Party official in Philadelphia named Charles Schenck spent $150 to have 15,000 political pamphlets printed. The United States had entered the war in Europe that spring, and Schenck was hoping to convince draft-age men not to serve. Quote, "When you conscript a man and compel him to go abroad and fight against his will," the tract argued, "you violate the most sacred right of personal liberty, as protected by the 13th Amendment. Exercise your rights of free speech." The headline over Schenck's essay read, "Long live the Constitution of the United States." A judge promptly issued a warrant for Schenck's arrest. Federal agents raided his office, seizing his pamphlets, and carted Schenck off to jail. Charged under the recently passed Espionage Act, he was convicted on 3 counts and sent to federal prison. It's hard to believe an American citizen could be jailed for expressing a political opinion, but it was common at the time. Schenck was one of thousands of Americans prosecuted by the Wilson administration for disagreeing with its policies. Remarkably, this did not seem to strike most Americans as strange or unconstitutional. Charles Schenck did not become a folk hero. His appeal, when it finally arrived at the Supreme Court, was unanimously denied. He died in obscurity. Only radicals cared about what happened to Charles Schenck. The American Civil Liberties Union was formed in 1920 in part as a reaction to his case and others like it. For decades after its founding, the ACLU took an absolutist position on the First Amendment. ACLU lawyers defended free speech in all cases, and with particular vigor when that speech was unpopular or outright despised. It sometimes seemed like there wasn't a villain or miscreant the ACLU wasn't eager to represent. Klansmen, communists, anti-Semites, pornographers, they all got free legal counsel when the ACLU determined that their right to speak was under attack. When a Denver theater owner was arrested for screening D.W. Griffith's film The Birth of a Nation, a local ordinance banned movies that incited race hatred, the ACLU defended him. When the U.S. Post Office burned copies of James Joyce's unreadable modernist novel Ulysses on obscenity grounds, the ACLU took the case to court. Militant atheists got help from the ACLU. So did any number of draft dodgers, as well as Jehovah's Witnesses who refused to salute the flag. Maybe the most reviled client the ACLU ever took was an American Nazi leader called Frank Collin. In 1977, Collin and a small group of self-styled fascists applied for a permit to march through the Chicago suburb of Skokie, Illinois. More than half of Skokie's residents were Jewish. Several thousand had survived Nazi concentration camps. The Nazis had chosen Skokie to cause maximum outrage, and they succeeded. The town of Skokie denied the permit. An Illinois judge later ratified that decision. The ACLU took the case. Everything about the ACLU's position on Skokie was offensive. Not only were its lawyers defending the National Socialist Party of America, but Frank Collin himself was cartoonishly repulsive, even by the standards of Nazis. He looked and dressed like Adolf Hitler, complete with a brown shirt, swastika armband, and greasy bangs. Collin later turned out to be half Jewish himself. His own father had been held at Dachau. Not long after Skokie, Collin went to prison for molesting boys. The ACLU represented Frank Collin all the way through the federal court system. Thousands of ACLU members quit in disgust. Many others withheld financial support. Some complained that not only did the ACLU defend Nazis, they'd sent a Jewish lawyer to do it. It was too much, even for the most fervent supporters of free speech. And you can see why. How could a decent person voluntarily represent Nazis? It was horrifying, but it was also revealing. You'd really have to believe in free speech to represent someone whose speech you despised, especially if it meant losing donors and being criticized by your neighbors. The ACLU really believed in free speech. Their dedication succeeded. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that even publicly marching with the swastika was protected speech. There was a time when the First Amendment qualified as secular scripture for educated Americans. They might abhor your views, but they'd die for your right to express them. That's what they always said, and there was clearly some truth in it. Freedom of speech was vital, not just because it's inherently gratifying to say what you think, but because speech is the foundational right of an open society. Free speech makes free thought possible. All other rights derive from it. The right to express your views is the final bulwark that shields the individual from the mob that disagrees with him. Without freedom of speech, we are not free. Interpretations of the First Amendment evolved over time, and for decades the ACLU looked for vehicles to expand them. In the summer of 1964, they found an unlikely one. Clarence Brandenburg was a small-time Ku Klux Klan leader from Western Ohio. In August of that year, he invited a Cincinnati TV station to film a rally consisting of about a dozen Klansmen. With cameras rolling, the group burned a cross, and Brandenburg gave a speech attacking blacks and Jews. "We're not a revengeant organization," he said, whatever that means, "but if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, it's possible there may have to be some revengeance taken." Police arrested Brandenburg for his words. An Ohio court convicted him of violating a state law that banned the promotion of, quote, crime, sabotage, violence, or unlawful methods of terrorism for political ends, and sent him to jail. The ACLU took up his appeal. 5 years later, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Clarence Brandenburg had a constitutional right to say what he did. The justices concluded that government could not limit expression except in cases where speech is, quote, directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to produce such action. Convincing rioters to torch a bank was prohibited. Calling for revolution, or in Clarence Brandenburg's words, revengeance, was not. In the opinion of Justice William O. Douglas, quote, government has no power to invade the sanctuary of belief and conscience. In practice, the Brandenburg versus Ohio decision allowed nearly every form of speech, no matter how odious. If threats from a robed Klansman ranting in front of a burning cross were constitutionally protected, all opinions are. Americans could say pretty much anything they wanted without fear of legal reprisal. Writers and intellectuals celebrated the decision as a critical victory for freedom and the rights of all Americans. In retrospect, this was the high watermark of American liberalism. Attitudes about speech began to change shortly thereafter. Though as late as the 1990s, you still heard old hippies describe the First Amendment as America's greatest achievement. Lots of places have market economies and democratic forms of government. Only the United States has the guarantee of free expression. Almost every other country prosecutes its citizens for having unpopular views, even in peaceful Canada. We don't. It's what sets America apart. This isn't just a free country, it's the freest. Radicals cared about the First Amendment because they knew they benefited from its protections. Freedom of speech doesn't exist for the sake of those in power. It exists to safeguard the rights of the unpopular and out of step. Martin Luther King was jailed for leading protests against segregation. Hundreds of suspected communists were blacklisted in Hollywood. People were fired from jobs for their beliefs. Radicals knew free speech mattered. When you're in the despised minority, being able to say what you think is the only real power you have. The opposite is also true. There's nothing more infuriating to a ruling class than contrary opinions. They're inconvenient and annoying. They're evidence of an ungrateful population. They impede the progress of your programs. Above all, they constitute a threat to your authority. Disagreement is the first step toward insurrection. When you're in charge, you'll do what you need to do to suppress dissent. The modern establishment has done exactly that. Once they took over the institutions they formerly opposed, liberals abandoned their historic support for the First Amendment and became its enemies. Nowhere was the change more profound or perverse than at the University of California, Berkeley, birthplace of the free speech movement. In 1964, a graduate student at Berkeley named Jack Weinberg set up a table on campus and began passing out unauthorized political literature. He was promptly arrested and thrown into a patrol car. Thousands of students surrounded the vehicle and prevented it from moving for more than a day. Joan Baez arrived to sing ballads of encouragement. Many hundreds of protesters were arrested, but in the end, Weinberg was released. School administrators caved to student demands for free expression. Berkeley's campus became synonymous with unfettered speech. It remained that way for the next 50 years. By the winter of 2017, when writer Milo Yiannopoulos arrived to speak, Berkeley had become the mirror image of its former self. Students were still willing to commit acts of civil disobedience, but this time they protested in order to silence a speaker. Activists at Berkeley accused Yiannopoulos of being, quote, a racist, misogynist demagogue who notoriously riles up a lynch mob mentality in his audiences with the aim of promoting violence. Jesse Aragwin, the mayor of Berkeley, agreed with the students. Using speech to silence marginalized communities and promote bigotry is unacceptable, Aragwin tweeted hours before the scheduled start of Yiannopoulos' event. Hate speech isn't welcome in our community. In order to show their disapproval of hate and violence, Berkeley students rioted. Protesters lit fires, smashed windows, and threw rocks. They committed at least $100,000 in property damage. Six people were injured, including a woman who had come to see Yiannopoulos speak. She was pepper sprayed in the face while giving an interview to a local news crew. Police, ordered by the city to do nothing, refused to act. Yiannopoulos fled for his safety with security guards in an unmarked car. He never gave his speech. Just a few months later, at a forum on progressive mayorships, Jesse Aragwin argued that people like Milo Yiannopoulos shouldn't be allowed to speak in public. Public safety is our top priority, he explained, and that actually, I believe, takes precedence over freedom of speech. It wasn't just Berkeley where Yiannopoulos found himself under attack. At DePaul University in 2016, a College Republicans event featuring Yiannopoulos was shut down when students stormed the stage and seized the microphone. Campus security staff did nothing to intervene or restore order. Afterward, school administrators released a statement affirming the value of free speech, but they didn't mean it. When the College Republicans sought to have Yiannopoulos return to campus, their request was denied on the grounds that the school couldn't provide adequate security for Yiannopoulos' quote, inflammatory speech. At least one school avoided a violent suppression of speech by simply refusing Yiannopoulos a platform in the first place. New York University canceled the Yiannopoulos event, claiming there were safety concerns because the proposed venue for the speech would have been physically close to the school's Islamic Center, an LGBTQ student center. Somehow, Yiannopoulos and his supporters were a threat to NYU's gay community, even though Yiannopoulos is himself a gay man and has never used his speeches to promote violence. Yiannopoulos is particularly loathed by the campus left, but he is hardly the only speaker who has been silenced. When author Ann Coulter tried to give a speech at Berkeley a few weeks after Yiannopoulos, university administrators canceled her appearance on the grounds they couldn't provide sufficient security to protect her from protesters, and then they blamed her for it. This is a university, not a battlefield, Chancellor Nicholas Dirks declared, as if Coulter's insistence on speaking out loud was responsible for the rioting. The New York Times agreed, claiming without evidence that UC Berkeley had, quote, become a target for small, militant, and shadowy right-wing groups. Across the country, students pushed to muzzle speakers they disagreed with, as administrators, politicians, and other establishment figures cheered them on. In 2014, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, a decidedly moderate Republican, canceled a planned speech at Rutgers University due to pressure from campus activists. The same happened to Henry Kissinger at the University of Texas and to former Democratic Senator Jim Webb at the U.S. Naval Academy, his alma mater. Brown University students called for the cancellation of a speech by former New York City Police Department Commissioner Ray Kelly, simply because he supported the policy of stop and frisk. Any deviation from orthodoxy was considered grounds for silencing. At Middlebury College in Vermont, hundreds of angry students shut down an appearance by social scientist Charles Murray, screaming at him until he gave up trying to speak. As Murray fled the scene, protesters assaulted the faculty member escorting him, putting her in the hospital with a concussion. The justification for attacks like this, ironically, was that certain ideas are so dangerous they constitute violence and must therefore be squelched by force. Punching a speaker you disagree with isn't assault, it's self-defense. To many student activists, sticks and stones may break bones, but words can be lethal and require a violent first strike. An essay in The Crimson, Harvard student newspaper, succinctly summed up the new orthodoxy. The, quote, dedication to complete freedom of speech, regardless of whether or not the speech is harassment, is alarming and indicative of a larger, troubling trend in American society. The First Amendment is alarming? Political differences are a crime? Students are growing up to believe that there is no longer such a thing as legitimate political debate. Free speech is a meaningless concept in a world with only one permissible set of political views. If the battle is between good and evil, only a fool would give evil equal time. No wonder students at DePaul called for hate crime charges against classmates who use sidewalk chalk to express support for Donald Trump. This backlash against free expression is hardly limited to public speakers. People's private remarks increasingly are being policed as well. At the University of Texas at San Antonio, a public school, philosophy grad student Alfred McDonald was summoned to his department chair's office over remarks he'd made to a fellow student. The student mentioned that she was engaged to a Muslim man. McDonald, who was bisexual, had replied by saying that he had a low opinion of Islam, since in 10 Muslim-majority countries, his sexual orientation could get him put to death. For the offense of honestly stating his views, McDonald was threatened with punishment by department head Eve Browning. We have not designed our program to tolerate these behaviors, Browning said, according to a secret recording McDonald made. We're not going to let you damage the program. When McDonald refused to apologize for expressing his opinion, Browning threatened to send him before something called the Behavior Intervention Team and warned he could be expelled. Instead, McDonald transferred to a new school. All that because McDonald said something completely true. In many Islamic countries, his lifestyle would get him executed, but that didn't matter. McDonald violated the sacred creed of multiculturalism. Free speech didn't stand a chance. McDonald's experience will grow more and more common as millennials age and take positions of leadership. A large and growing proportion of Americans under 30, the country's most liberal cohort, don't believe in unfettered free speech. According to a Pew survey, 40% of millennials think the government should have the power to ban statements offensive to minority groups. A 2017 Cato Institute survey found that 52% of self-identified Democrats of all ages viewed government suppression of offensive speech as more important than the unfettered right to say whatever one wants. A growing percentage of the country endorses not only restrictions on the First Amendment, but also the use of extra-legal violence in the face of offensive ideas. In the hours after Donald Trump's inauguration in January 2017, White supremacist leader Richard Spencer was punched in the face by a stranger without provocation. The incident sparked a wave of debate from the New York Times to Twitter about whether it was okay to punch a Nazi. One survey found that the majority of people who described themselves as strong liberals approved. There isn't much scholarly disagreement about what the text of the First Amendment says about free expression. The words are unambiguous. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble. The debate is over what the term speech means. In the 1980s, a group of law professors invented an extra constitutional category known as hate speech, which they claimed fell outside the protections of the First Amendment. It's not clear how they arrived at this. The Constitution says nothing about hate speech. The Supreme Court has never ruled on it. Yet on many campuses, hate speech was treated as a valid legal term with a precise and objective meaning. Symposia were held on it. Professors taught sober-sounding classes on it. Students, for the most part, accepted the existence of hate speech uncritically. So did the rest of the establishment. In 2017, Howard Dean, who was not only governor of Vermont, but at one point even a presidential frontrunner, announced on Twitter, "Hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment." Dean is not known for his intellectual power, so it's possible he believed this. But what accounts for CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, who was a lawyer making an identical claim? Cuomo was once the chief law and justice correspondent for ABC News. During the debate over Milo Yiannopoulos at Berkeley, he tweeted this, "Hate speech is excluded from protection. Don't just say you love the Constitution, read it." By the time Trump was elected, even the ACLU had given up on unfettered speech. After the group defended the right of conservative activists to rally in Charlottesville, Virginia during the summer of 2017, some of its own staffers revolted. More than 200 ACLU employees signed a letter complaining that the group's broader mission was being undermined by, quote, a rigid stance on free speech. The National ACLU caved, ending almost 100 years of First Amendment absolutism. When you sincerely believe you possess the truth, all disagreement looks like apostasy. For the greater good, it must be silenced. It's distressing when academics take this view. It's terrifying when prosecutors do. In 2015, a Wisconsin district attorney named John Chisholm launched an investigation into conservative activists who helped Governor Scott Walker win election. Though no actual crime had been committed, Chisholm was clearly offended that anyone would aid the Walker campaign. He and a prosecutor named Francis Schmitz ordered police to raid activists' homes, denied them access to counsel, and imposed orders that prevented them from telling anybody about what was going on. One target described the terror she felt during a pre-dawn police raid as cops flooded into her house and seized her family's computers and cell phones. She never learned what crime she was alleged to have committed. Wisconsin's Supreme Court ultimately intervened. The justices concluded that prosecutors had, quote, disregarded the vital principle that in our nation and our state, political speech is a fundamental right. Chisholm's contempt for the First Amendment, the court said, assured that such political speech will be investigated with paramilitary-style home invasions conducted in the pre-dawn hours and then prosecuted and punished. The court particularly excoriated Chisholm for simply inventing new legal doctrines to suit his predetermined political purposes. Quote, "It is utterly clear that the prosecutor has employed theories of law that do not exist in order to investigate citizens who are wholly innocent of any wrongdoing," the decision concluded. In California, that state's Attorney General, Javier Becerra, filed a complaint against the Center for Medical Progress, a group of anti-abortion activists, accusing them of illegally recording their conversations with clinic operators without consent. For this, Becerra charged the organization with 15 felonies, a response so disproportionate that even the Los Angeles Times couldn't find a precedent for it. Tellingly, Becerra did not charge NBC for secretly recording Donald Trump on what became the now-famous Access Hollywood tape. In 2015, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse announced he had uncovered a massive and sophisticated campaign designed to mislead Americans about climate change. Rather than rebut that misinformation with his own views, Whitehouse called for prosecution. Whitehouse demanded that oil companies and their trade associations face a federal suit under the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, the same law used to take down the mob. In White House's view, disagreement with him on climate change wasn't grounds for debate, but for prosecution. White House wasn't alone. In 2016, Attorney General Loretta Lynch told Congress that the possibility for suing climate deniers, quote, had been discussed within the Justice Department. The department weighed the idea seriously enough to ask the FBI if a RICO case could be made. At the state level, 17 attorneys general teamed up to pursue similar prosecutions of heretics. California's Kamala Harris, now the state's junior U.S. senator, launched an investigation into ExxonMobil for taking a position contrary to her own on climate change. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Al Gore all endorsed it. The prosecutions weren't happening fast enough for one California state senator, who introduced SB 1161, the California Climate Science Truth and Accountability Act of 2016. The bill would have made it illegal for citizens to disseminate, quote, scientifically inaccurate or misleading information about climate change. Considering that scientific accuracy is always a moving target, especially on a topic as complex as climate, this amounts to the criminalization of differences of opinion. But nowhere is speech more threatened than in Silicon Valley. In the spring of 2014, Brendan Eich became CEO of Mozilla Firefox, a company he helped found. 10 days later, he was forced to resign. Bloggers had discovered that 6 years earlier, Eich had donated money to Proposition 8, a referendum that banned gay marriage in California. Proposition 8 had passed by a wide margin. Fully 70% of California's black population supported it. The year it became law, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama publicly opposed gay marriage. In 2008, Eich's position was hardly a fringe view. None of that mattered. Eich was pushed out of his company for violating a never-specified but universally understood set of rules about what people are allowed to believe in Silicon Valley. The company marked Eich's departure with a press release celebrating Mozilla's culture of, quote, diversity and inclusiveness. In a flourish that even by tech company standards lacked self-awareness, Mozilla went on to boast that its culture of openness extends to encouraging staff and community to share their beliefs and opinions in public. In 2016, investor Peter Thiel was one of the rare Silicon Valley executives willing to donate to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Fellow tech investors immediately demanded that Thiel lose his seat on the board of Facebook on the grounds that supporting Trump was tantamount to committing violence. Giving more power to someone whose ascension and behavior strike fear into so many people is unacceptable, explained Ellen Pao, herself the former head of the popular discussion site Reddit. Trump's views, Pao wrote, are more than just political speech. Fueled by hate and encouraging violence, they make each of us feel unsafe. If tech executives will say things like this in public, it's fair to wonder how their political views affect the products they sell. It's worth worrying about. Fewer than half a dozen technology companies have an effective monopoly on the bulk of information Americans consume. What if Silicon Valley decided to let only one side speak? The social media giant Twitter barely hides its contempt for free speech, regularly banning or locking the accounts of users for hateful conduct, a term it keeps usefully subjective. Milo Yiannopoulos was banned by Twitter in the summer of 2016. Within a week of Donald Trump's election victory, the site carried out a purge of accounts associated with the alt-right, even if they had broken no rules. Political operative and Donald Trump advisor Roger Stone was suspended in the fall of 2017 for criticizing CNN personalities. Meanwhile, Twitter awarded a verification, a blue check that signifies an account is legitimate, to the Muslim Brotherhood before it gave one to the conservative site Breitbart. No tech company has clamped down on speech more aggressively than Google, the most powerful company of all. In August 2017, a Google software engineer named James Damore wrote a memo assessing the company's political culture. It could have described any large Silicon Valley company. At Google, wrote Damore, we talk so much about unconscious bias as it applies to race and gender, but we rarely discuss our moral biases. Political orientation is actually a result of deep moral preferences and thus biases. Considering that the overwhelming majority of the social sciences, media, and Google lean left, we should critically examine these prejudices. Over the course of 10 pages, Damore examined these prejudices in some detail. Notable among them is the belief that bigotry is the main impediment to professional advancement. There are fewer female engineers than male engineers, liberals believe, because men are biased against women. Damore suspected that wasn't the whole story. "We need to stop assuming that gender gaps imply sexism," he wrote. "On average, men and women biologically differ in many ways. These differences aren't just socially constructed." Damore, a former childhood chess prodigy with a graduate degree in biology from Harvard, was precise and non-polemical in his assertions. In part, he seemed nearly apologetic. "I'm simply stating that the distribution of preferences and abilities of men and women differ in part due to their biological causes," he wrote, "and that these differences may explain why we don't see equal representation of women in tech and leadership. Many of these differences are small, and there's a significant overlap between men and women, so you can't say anything about an individual given these population-level distributions." Damore wrote the memo on a flight to China as a way of organizing his thoughts. He never intended it to be shared beyond a circle of friends. Within a short time, the paper leaked to a popular tech blog. A political explosion followed. Danielle Brown, Google's vice president of diversity, released a statement charging Damore with having, quote, "incorrect assumptions about gender." Brown didn't explain what those assumptions were or how they were incorrect. She didn't need to. Nobody in the press asked. Google's CEO flew home from a family vacation in Europe to respond to the crisis. Many of Damore's fellow employees, meanwhile, howled for his dismissal. One former Google executive wrote an op-ed saying Damore should be, quote, "escorted from the building by security and told that your personal items will be mailed to you." Others fantasized on social media about assaulting Damore. Nearly all news organizations described the essay as an anti-diversity memo, when in fact Damore had argued strenuously that Google's culture needed more diversity. Vox called it a sexist screed, as though Damore's essay were a deranged rant and not a carefully reasoned piece. Within days, Damore had been fired by the company. In perhaps the most Orwellian statement written since Orwell himself finished 1984, Google explained the decision this way, quote, "Part of building an open, inclusive environment means fostering a culture in which those with alternative views, including different political views, feel safe sharing their opinions. In order to foster a culture in which those with alternative political views could feel safe sharing their opinions, Google fired James Damore for the crime of sharing his alternative views. At no point did the company rebut any of the points Damore made. The fact that he made them was enough. Damore was a thought criminal, and his crime was raising the wrong questions." The establishment applauded. Many pointed out that the First Amendment didn't apply to Damore because Google isn't a government entity. This is a murkier area than it appears. Government regulates all sorts of speech in the private sector. Employers can't fire workers for expressing their religious views, for example. In some states, such as California and New York, that protection extends to political beliefs. Whether Damore's firing was constitutional awaits clarification from the courts. But what happened to James Damore is more than a legal matter. It raises the most basic civic question of all. What kind of society do we want to live in? Among intellectuals, the answer used to be obvious and widely agreed upon. The goal is a free society. You knew what that meant because all free societies share the same features. They tolerate dissent, they prize reason and encourage civility, they discourage witch hunts and groupthink. They try to ensure that people aren't punished for saying what they think. They recognize that truth is always a defense. Every nation tries to influence how its citizens behave, but a free society never presumes to control what people believe. That's for the individual alone to decide. For a moment in time, the taste-making class in America claimed to believe all of this, and the country was a better place for it. The majority of journalists and intellectuals in 1975 would never have accepted the lame excuse that silencing, firing, and ruining people for holding an opinion was fine, as long as it wasn't specifically the government doing it. They would have declared that a free country depends above all on free minds. An open society needs open discourse, or else it is merely an echo chamber. They would have spoken, rallied, and sued on behalf of James Damore, Brendan Eich, and Milo Yiannopoulos. But now members of the same class run Google, UC Berkeley, and virtually every other powerful institution in America. Suddenly, free speech looks a lot more like a threat than a virtue. If you're wondering why prominent media figures no longer seem curious about what government agencies might be doing to Americans without their knowledge, this is the answer. For generations, journalists believed their job was to hold the powerful accountable. This very much included unelected bureaucrats committing unseen sins in the hidden recesses of the federal government. In 1975, the media raised to prominence an obscure U.S. senator from Idaho called Frank Church, after Church led investigations into the activities of the CIA, NSA, FBI, and other mystery-shrouded government agencies. Church suspected the government was up to something shady. He was right. The CIA, it turned out, had engaged in multiple assassination plots against foreign leaders, all without congressional approval or oversight. The FBI, meanwhile, seemed to have virtually every prominent American under surveillance of some kind, sometimes for purely political reasons. The Bureau bugged Martin Luther King's hotel rooms, discovered he was an enthusiastic adulterer, and then tried to blackmail him with that information. At one point, agents sent King an unsigned letter suggesting he ought to commit suicide. Federal agencies opened private mail without a warrant and secretly inspected the contents. The NSA read hundreds of thousands of telegrams sent into and out of the United States. Under the pretext of fighting the Cold War, federal bureaucrats spied extensively on their fellow citizens, mostly because they could. Reporters were outraged. Church's hearings forced a series of much-needed reforms, including the creation of congressional committees designed to oversee the intelligence agencies, and the passage of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to regulate domestic spying. These were heralded at the time as meaningful achievements, bulwarks against the abuse of government power. The Church hearings are all but forgotten today, along with the attitudes that animated them. Democrats now compete with Republicans to see who can express more admiration for law enforcement and intelligence agencies. They are joined in that by mainstream journalists. Television news anchors spent the first months of the Trump administration sneering at the idea that government agencies might have spied on Trump advisors during the presidential campaign. Anyone who suggested it actually happened was dismissed as unstable or a hack. When it emerged that the Obama Justice Department had indeed spied on the Trump campaign, the posture of most in the press didn't change. CNN legal correspondent Jeff Toobin dismissed questions about the spying as, quote, lunatic conspiracy theories. Jill Abramson, a former top editor at the New York Times, suggested that criticism of the Justice Department was near treasonous. Quote, Trump's attack on the FBI is an attack on the U.S. Constitution itself, she wrote. Meanwhile, TV networks larded their evening lineups with retired government officials eager to defend their agencies, not to mention themselves. MSNBC hired former CIA director John Brennan as a contributor. Brennan was on the air frequently, but anchors refrained from asking about his role in the agency's targeted killing of Americans or in the cover-up of the CIA's torture program. Not to be outdone, CNN hired retired Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. Clapper was most famous for lying in testimony to Congress in 2013. Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Asked Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. No, Clapper replied, not wittingly. A few months later, Edward Snowden leaked internal NSA documents that showed the government had scooped up the phone records of more than 100 million Americans without their knowledge or their consent. Clapper had lied. Yet he was almost never asked about this on CNN. Instead, Clapper was allowed to use his remaining moral authority to bat down further questions about government spying. Journalists had become handmaidens to power. Most of them despised Donald Trump and his party. A survey during the Obama administration found not a single Republican in the White House press corps. But the main reason the press lost interest in holding the permanent government accountable is that they had more in common with its members than with the rest of the country. They share the same life experiences and cultural assumptions as the people they cover. The people in power are the neighbors and former classmates of members of the press. On the most basic level, the two groups have become indistinguishable. Chapter 5, The Diversity Diversion. What would happen if large numbers of Americans actually understood the federal tax code? All sorts of questions might arise. Why do we tax capital at half the rate of labor? That might be the first one. Why is it fair that some inherited money loser, living off the interest from an investment portfolio he didn't create, pays half the taxes per dollar that you do? You get up every morning to go to work. He stays home, smokes weed, and watches online porn. You get hit twice as hard on April 15th. He's being rewarded while you're being punished. Is he twice as necessary as you are? Does he contribute twice as much to America? Maybe he does. Maybe the people who wrote the tax code could explain precisely how. Maybe not. Either way, you can see how a conversation like that might quickly spin out of control and become a threat to the existing order. Better not to have it in the first place. Better to change the subject away from economics entirely. Identity politics is a handy way to do that. It's not a coincidence that since the life expectancy of working-class whites in America has declined, elite attacks on working-class whites have escalated. White men now kill themselves at about 10 times the rate of black or Hispanic women. Yet white men are consistently framed as the oppressors, particularly blue-collar white men. This happens to be the only group in America whose average wages have declined consistently over decades. Their privilege is nevertheless a threat to the rest of us, we're told. They've managed to destroy entire cities very few of them have ever been to, from Detroit to Newark to Baltimore. They lower test scores in schools they don't attend. They cause poor nutrition, asthma, and broken families in black neighborhoods, and in their spare time, they exacerbate global warming. They may be dying off before their time, but working-class white men are immensely powerful. Who came up with this storyline? It's hard to know for sure, but you'd have to guess it was someone trying to cover his tracks. If you'd failed in your responsibility to the people you were in charge of helping, if they started dying younger or found their drinking water contaminated with lead, you'd be very concerned about being blamed for that. You'd want people to blame one another instead. The quickest way to control a population is to turn it against itself, divide and conquer. That's how the British ruled India. If you wanted to run a country for the benefit of the people who live there, by contrast, you would do the opposite of this. You'd de-emphasize racial differences. You'd understand that in a society composed of many different ethnic groups, tribalism is the greatest threat to unity and order. Of course, there will always be racism because that's the nature of people, and you'd work to discourage it. But you would resist using the existence of racism as an excuse for your failures. You would never, for example, blame an entire racial group for the sins of its ancestors. That would serve only to embitter and divide the population. It might make your job easier in the short term, but over time it would wreck your country. The ruling class once understood this. In May 2017, Harvard University held its first ever segregated graduation ceremony. Black students have attended Harvard since just after the Civil War, and for almost 150 years, they graduated alongside their white classmates. This was a fact the school was proud of. But in 2017, the school discarded that tradition and created something called Black Commencement, held 2 days before the regular graduation ceremony. Hundreds attended. Spoken word performers reminded the audience, quote, "We don't need the white man nor white girl pity." Press coverage was adulatory. Boston's local NPR affiliate described the event as an opportunity for black students to, quote, "celebrate their triumphs and remember the obstacles they have faced." The Boston Globe agreed. Unlike the cliched send-offs often delivered at commencements, the newspaper explained, the speeches at this event spoke to the political and social concerns that students of color face at an elite institution. It's hard to overstate how strange it is to see establishment figures celebrating a black-only graduation ceremony. For generations, school integration was the one issue that united every right-thinking person in America. The educated class fought segregation everywhere they found it. They celebrated when the Brown versus Board of Education decision abolished separate but equal schools nationwide. They supported James Meredith when he integrated the University of Mississippi. They despised George Wallace and other political leaders who fought to keep black and white students apart. They weren't satisfied with schools either. Idealistic young members of the ruling class led the integration of restaurants, hotels, theaters, public transportation. They argued that all human beings were equal in dignity and rights. Everyone deserved to be treated equally in the eyes of the law. They were right about all of this. Racial segregation was wrong, and not just because black schools tended to get less state funding. Segregation divided people on the basis of things they couldn't control. It suggested that a person's race, an entirely immutable characteristic, was the most important thing about him and should determine how he was treated by others. Segregation was dehumanizing. It reduced the individual to a faceless member of a group. It was also, its critics often pointed out, absurd. Beneath the skin were all the same. Civic leaders said that constantly in the 1970s and 80s. They recited Martin Luther King speeches to drive home the point. For decades, racial integration was the central project of American elites. Some may believe it still is, but a remarkable transformation has taken place. Elites no longer oppose segregation. They no longer insist on treating all races equally. Many instead call for segregation. They consider race the center of human identity. They demand that individuals be exalted or punished because of their skin color. In the spring of 2018, CNN interrupted its ongoing coverage of the diabolical Russian plot to undermine democracy with a breaking story. According to several sources, Trump's Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, may once have endorsed the principle of meritocratic hiring. Zinke, a former Navy SEAL, apparently said out loud that diversity was less important than, quote, having the right person for the right job. CNN made it clear that this was a scandal, if not a threat to the country. Skill-based hiring in 2018? The network ran this ominous chyron beneath its coverage, quote, Zinke angers many by saying it's more important to find the best people. Washington erupted. Zinke's spokeswoman did her best to quell the fury. She assured reporters that the rumors were false. Secretary Zinke, she said, absolutely does not hire employees on the basis of their skills or ability or experience. Instead, Zinke uses criteria like genetics and physical appearance to make the call. Ryan Zinke believes in diversity. Journalists remain skeptical. Zinke has said he cares about excellence, and what's important is having the right person for the right job, CNN reminded viewers. Statements like this reinforce the dated and bigoted thinking that diversity threatens quality. These ideas threaten the security of the country. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, recently returned from an acquittal in his federal corruption trial, released a statement equating meritocratic hiring with racism. Zinke, Menendez said, is trying to create a, quote, lily white department. If you've been following the evolution of elite views on race, this is all a little bewildering. It is precisely the opposite of what people like Bob Menendez were saying 40 years ago. Meritocratic attitudes were once considered the answer to racism, not a manifestation of it. People should be judged on what they do, not on how they look or who their parents were or what their ancestors did. Our elites once said they didn't believe in collective punishment or reward. They stood with the individual. That's why they opposed segregation. In the fall of 2016, a protest broke out at the University of California, Berkeley. Protests over racial questions are common at Berkeley and long have been. The campus was the site of some of the first student demonstrations against racial segregation in the early 1960s. But this protest was different. It was staged in favor of segregation. Activists raised a banner that read, "Fight for spaces of color." They formed a human chain to block white students from entering the campus. "Whose university? Our university," they chanted. They demanded public spaces from which heterosexual whites could be excluded. At the time, Berkeley already supported a number of race-centered facilities. The school funded an Equity Resource Center, the Fannie Lou Hamer Black Resource Center, the African American Student Development Center, the Office of Native American Student Development, a Chicano Student Development Center, the Asian Pacific American Student Development Space. These facilities were designed for students of color, but they weren't officially limited to them. The protesters demanded space entirely off limits to white people. Whites are a shrinking minority at Berkeley, just about 24% of undergraduates. But according to the protesters, any was too many. They demanded a segregated meeting area within the university's MLK Student Union. Nobody acknowledged the irony of banning people on the basis of skin color from a building named after Martin Luther King. At the University of Michigan, students followed suit. They called for school administrators to create a permanent designated space on Central Campus for black students and students of color to organize and do social justice work. Activists criticized the existing multicultural center for not being solely dedicated to community organizing and social justice work specifically for people of color. They wanted a black-only space, a segregated space. Similar demonstrations took place all over the country. Once colleges accepted segregated public spaces, there was no reason not to segregate living quarters as well. The University of Colorado Boulder now has housing exclusively for black students. So does the University of Connecticut. California State University, Los Angeles, maintains what it calls black-focused housing. Cornell College in Iowa has a dormitory for black students, which the school describes as, quote, a place of refuge for anyone who has felt discriminated against because of their race, sexuality, spirituality, gender, or ideas as a human being. The University of Iowa offers a young, gifted, and black